Big news. One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate. Sometimes what you think is the story isn't really the story. Artificial intelligence from the consumer's perspective. On the program today from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 21st day of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are not, repeat, not on this program going to try to recap the soap opera that is OpenAI. Too much drama, honestly, not enough time. We will instead take the bigger picture approach. What all of this mess means for artificial intelligence and this economy. The end of this month, it's going to be 1 year since ChatGPT was rolled out to the public. So Marketplace's Matt Levin starts us off today with how businesses are actually using and not using generative AI.
Last year, AI specialist Brett Greenstein at the consulting firm PwC knew ChatGPT was a big deal when he got a phone call from someone very much not in tech.
Within 2 weeks, my mom was calling me with examples of stuff she did. She didn't use a microwave for like a decade because it was too new.
Greenstein spends most of his time helping companies incorporate generative AI in their workflows. He says for now, businesses are trusting the tech more for internal uses.
Back office, finance, supply chain, procurement, HR, IT, those kinds of things.
Two-thirds of companies surveyed by the publisher O'Reilly were using generative AI in some way. Amin Ahmad at the enterprise AI company Vectara says the best evidence that a sea change is underway is how many CEOs are calling him.
We started in 2020. It was hard to get people's attention. But I think there was no business owner out there that when they were exposed to ChatGPT couldn't imagine that there was some application for this technology to make their own business more efficient.
It helps that these AI tools are really good at language translation. Adoption is global. But consider how much better the tech has already gotten in just 12 months. For one thing, ChatGPT is much less prone to make stuff up. So economist Anton Koronek at the University of Virginia is kind of surprised we're not all using it all the time.
So there's this increasing schism between what it can do and what people are actually using it for.
Some of that may simply be fearful employees. At Stanford Business School, Professor Mohsin Bayati always advises execs to bring in subject matter experts when designing AI systems, say a doctor for some health AI. But corporate executives are telling him that's getting harder now.
We are having difficulty to have the domain experts sit on the same table anymore because they're thinking they're just helping build something that would replace them.
Yep. Every time I use ChatGPT, I kind of get that feeling too. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Maybe someday artificial intelligence is going to be in charge of this economy, but for now, the Federal Reserve still gets to decide, which I mention as a way to talk about the minutes of the central bank's most recent meeting, which came out today. This is the meeting that ended November 1st, if you have lost track, which I totally get. Anyway, here's the skinny. I'll give it to you in one somewhat tortured Fed speak quote. Here you go. Participants expected that the data arriving in coming months would help clarify the extent to which the disinflation process was continuing. Aggregate demand was moderating in the face of tighter financial and credit conditions, and labor markets were reaching a better balance between demand and supply. Or in regular person speak, if I might, they're looking for data on inflation keeping on going down, consumers cutting back on spending, and the labor market softening, which is what they've been saying for a good long while now. Wall Street on this day before the day before Thanksgiving, a little soft. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The The internet is global, yes, sure, but the internet is not the same globally. In Europe, they've got robust privacy protections, just for instance, not the same as here. You can use apps here, Uber and WhatsApp, to name just two, that you can't use in China. They do over there, though, have an internet economy with apps like WeChat and Alipay and Didi. But for foreigners in China, trying to even get those apps working is no easy thing, as Marketplace's Jennifer Pack reports.
At the Shanghai Global Food Trade Show, some first-time visitors to China are having lunch at McDonald's. Aditya Ugave and Giant Punikar work for an Indian spice company called Suwana, and they're having trouble getting their phones working.
Actually, most of the time the Wi-Fi isn't connected. I don't know what the problem is. And even when it connects, there are errors happening.
At least they were able to pay in cash. People in China usually pay through apps like WeChat Pay and Alipay. Recently, users have been allowed to link foreign credit cards to their accounts. That doesn't work for American business advisor Tim McClellan, though he found a loophole.
Cash, meaning I give somebody cash and then they send me the money that goes into my WeChat Pay.
I didn't think that works unless you have a Chinese account.
I don't have a Chinese account, but it works. I don't know what to tell you.
It is a bit of a mystery why some apps work for foreigners and others don't. I just unlocked this bike from the shared ride app Meituan. It took me, 3 years to get the app working, and I live here. But unless you have a Chinese phone, a Chinese ID, and a Chinese bank account, the apps don't always run smoothly. So have a backup plan, says Napat Murin, who exports Thai rice crackers. She has Alipay, but still carries cash.
Because sometimes when you're struggling with a scan, payment, at least you have some cash.
China has never been easy for businesses, but China today is a much more open place, says Jason Hoffmeister, the acting deputy undersecretary for U.S. Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs. He is grilling some ribeye at the U.S. meat export booth.
When I came to China first in 1996, it was a very hard place to do business. The right to trade was severely restricted to government entities. The permits were required, high tariffs, and U.S. exported less than $1 billion of agriculture products.
Today, China is a $40 billion export market for U.S. agricultural products. Many of the barriers have been removed, Hoffmeister says. Maybe not the digital ones. Though, for him, access to Chinese apps doesn't matter anyway, since the U.S. government has national security concerns and wouldn't allow him to download them on his phone. Things run more smoothly if your country is on good terms with China. Alexander Shubin is a marshmallow factory director from Russia. He says his cell phone data, all the apps he uses back home, work just fine in China. And if your cell phone data or apps aren't working, maybe China isn't the only one to blame, says Australian wine exporter Vikas Gupta.
It's not only one way China.
He says a lot depends on your phone carrier and whether your home country has put up a firewall. And yes, China bans most major Western apps like Instagram, Facebook Messenger, and all things Google. But India has also blocked over 200 Chinese apps after a border dispute with China. So our first-time visitors at McDonald's, Aditya and Giant, can't download WeChat, Alipay, or Baidu Translate. And the apps they normally use in India?
WhatsApp, Telegram, Gmail.
Aditya says none of them work. He can't keep in touch with any of his customers outside of China.
We are just texting them from our Indian numbers that we are not available for these days. We will connect with them after this exhibition.
Meaning they're off-grid while doing business in the world's second largest economy. Still, they say they plan to come back next year. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
As we really ramp up into the holiday shopping season, just 33 shopping days till Christmas, gang, let's spare a thought for the people on the other side of the retail register, shall we? Up today in our semi-regular survey of small business people we keep in touch with, Vanita Cooper, she runs Silhouette Sneakers and Art in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Business definitely feels like it's been picking up a little bit for the holidays. We're definitely selling more sneakers than we were probably at the end of quarter three. Typically for the holiday season, I spend a lot more time in the store, and I think that's going to be true this time as well. And I also, you know, spend a lot more time thinking about promotions and marketing, and it's possible actually that we will start being more aggressive with email marketing. Apologies to the people out there who hate email marketing, but it is a proven strategy, and so we're probably going to be doing that more. Just over the course of the year, I'm observing that more people are coming in for special occasions, birthdays, etc. And so people do tend to open up their wallets for Christmas. What's interesting is, like, there's a lot of cute conversations with, like, parents and kids in the store. I had this one mom bring her son in, and he picked out a pair of shoes that he liked, and she was like, okay, well, this is going to be your Christmas gift. Is that okay with you? And he, like, really had to sit there and debate it. He was like, wait a minute. He brought up something else that he wanted, and she was like, well, this is going to be your gift. And so he really sat there. I'm thinking, dude, choose the shoes, obviously. so he chose the shoes. Good news. And I'm betting he's going to get this other thing that he wants to. Over the holiday season this year, I'm really hoping to, you know, at least match our numbers from last year. I've tried to curate a more diverse selection of sneakers in terms of price point. And so, you know, fewer $1,000+ sneakers in the store and more, you know, sneakers in the $200 to $300 range. And then, you know, it's like, it's just a fast time of the year, you know, and so everything just happens really quickly. It's kind of a whirlwind. It's a lot of fun.
Vanita Cooper braving that whirlwind at Silhouette Sneakers and Art. She's in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Coming up.
I'm looking for 20 people. Prep cooks, line cooks.
Somebody's got to do the cooking, right? First, though. Let's us do the numbers. Dow Industrial is down 62 points today, almost 0.2%, closed at 35,088. The NASDAQ retreated 84 points, 0.6%, 14,199. S&P 500 reversed 9 points, 0.2%, 45.38 there. We got a rickety shopping cart full of retail earnings news today. Lowe's sank 3% after reporting worse than expected revenue. The home improvement chain also lowered its full-year sales outlook, saying people aren't so into DIY projects lately. Yep, I get that. Kohl's lost 8.5%, also on weaker than expected revenue. Store sales down 5.5%. American Eagle, get this, plunged nearly 16% today after revenue guidelines for the full year was less than hoped for. On the bright side of retail, Dick's Sporting Goods rose about 2.2% today after stronger than expected quarterly earnings and revenue. Burlington Stores, once upon a time known as Burlington Coat Factory, soared 22.0%. After saying it expected 11% sales growth in 2024. Bond prices were up. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 4.41%. You're listening to Marketplace.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, Well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. From the National Association of Realtors this morning came word that sales of existing homes were down last month, off 4% from September, almost 15% lower than a year ago. Prices, meanwhile, keep going up. Nationally, the median home price is bumping up against $392,000. Mortgage rates, I mean, do I really have to say? Is it any wonder, then, that it's taking people longer to actually get into a home? I mentioned this yesterday real quick, but it is worth digging into just a bit. The median age of first-time home buyers in this economy is now 35. That's up from 29 back in 1981. The median age of all home buyers, now 49, up from 31. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has more on that.
There are a bunch of reasons it's taking people longer to buy homes now than it used to.
Housing prices have gone up much more than incomes have over the last 40 years.
Jenny Schutz is at the Brookings Institution.
And that means both that you have to have higher income to be able to afford the monthly mortgage payments, but also that it's going to take a bigger down payment to get into home ownership.
So people have to work and save, often for many more years. And more young people are going to college now than a few decades ago, which means they're starting their working lives later. And Schutz says taking on more debt.
This is really important because in addition to the income needed to qualify for a mortgage and having the savings for a down payment, lenders also look at your debt-to-income ratio.
And the more you're spending on student loans, the less you have for a down payment or a mortgage. All of that has been true for a while. Then came the pandemic and the huge run-up in home prices and mortgage rates. Brandy Snowden at the National Association of Realtors says to get into the market now, you need to make a lot more money than you did even just a couple of years ago.
Just between 2021 and 2022, for first-time home buyers, household incomes rose nearly $25,000 just from that previous year.
The median household income for first-time home buyers is now nearly $96,000. That's well over the national median income, which is about $75,000.
The surge over the past 2 years has just been such a shock to the affordability levels of potential home buyers.
Daniel McHugh at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies says the longer people have to wait to become homeowners, the less time they have to build equity and wealth, and the more pressure there is on the rental market, too.
Which kind of is a self-perpetuating system, because when rents go up, it's harder for younger people to save up that down payment because they're spending so much money on their rents.
Which could mean it takes even longer before renters can become homeowners. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
There's been quite the ebb and flow in Americans' savings the past 3-4 years. We socked lots of money away early on in the pandemic, but as inflation started to bite and government relief programs started to expire, bank balances started to go south and people have been increasingly relying on credit cards to get by, and also by tapping into their retirement accounts. The latest data on this, Fidelity Investments reported this week that the percentage of workers making what are called hardship withdrawals from their retirement accounts ticked up again in the third quarter to 2.3%. Now, yes, that is a small percentage of the American labor force, but A, it is almost 4 million people, and B, those withdrawals could have big implications for all those people in the long run, as Marketplace's Henry App reports.
A hardship withdrawal from a retirement account has to be for an actual hardship, says Mike Shamrell with Fidelity.
It's not like they are looking to take a vacation or go to their college roommate's bachelorette party in Napa or something like that.
The most common reasons for these kinds of withdrawals in Fidelity's latest report, avoiding eviction or foreclosure and paying medical expenses. Teresa Ghilarducci is a professor of economics at the New School.
So it's just part of that whole scene of households not having as much wealth
and having more debt than they did in the last couple of years.
Inflation and student loan repayments are already draining American savings, she says. So when they're hit with an emergency expense, their retirement funds are their only backup. In the short term, they'll have to pay taxes on those withdrawals, she says, which can hurt long term, too.
Most people who take it out are people who are prone to financial trouble, and so they don't make it up later on in life. And they end up in retirement with a much higher risk of being poor.
But a hardship withdrawal may be better than other options, says Angie Chen at Boston College's Center for Retirement Research.
Because then they're not accessing debt measures or credit cards to pay off these expenses.
But the fact that some Americans are facing these choices at all points to a bigger problem, says Greg McBride, a financial analyst at Bankrate.
Americans are undersaved for emergencies and retirement as well, but that's not a new trend. That's become as much of the American fabric as baseball and apple pie.
It may be slow to roll out, McBride says, but next year there is a new federal law taking effect that will make it easier to access retirement funds for emergencies. I'm Henry Ebb for Marketplace.
There's more to having a job than just having a job. Work goes to a sense of self-worth, of making a contribution, and yes, of course, getting a paycheck. For the millions of people who've come to the United States as refugees, finding work is the first step in establishing a new life here, and getting a federal work permit is typically the first step in that process. There are jobs out there, but companies can't hire migrants who want to work but don't yet have that work authorization. Esther Yoon-Ji Kang from WBEZ went to a job fair for refugees in Chicago.
In early November, when Siam Pasarlai arrived to set up the job fair event, dozens of Venezuelan migrants were waiting outside on a windy morning before the doors opened.
They came at 8 o'clock. They were waiting outside. 8 o'clock. They came earlier than us because they need jobs.
Pasarlai is a refugee himself. The 33-year-old fled the Taliban in Afghanistan nearly 2 years ago. This is the second refugee job fair he's organized for documented workers to connect with employers.
We invite hospitalities, restaurants, hotels. We invite the manufacturing companies, the construction, the services industry. We invite the senior care centers.
In the community room of a nonprofit, Basarlai has set up tables and signs for dozens of employers and a handful of social service groups.
Okay, I'm going to text you the link to the application, okay?
Recent immigrants often have to wait before they're authorized to work. In September, the Biden administration expedited work permits for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans who arrived in the U.S. before August. Nearly 500 people registered for the job fair, and most have work permits. But some do not, like Venezuelan migrants who arrived in the U.S. in August or later. Word had spread about the job fair, and Pasarlai says many are here even if they're not authorized to work.
They're desperate for job. I cannot negotiate on behalf of them to the companies because without documents you cannot have job.
Yobesi Estrada is one of these migrants. The 40-year-old mother of two arrived in the U.S. after the Biden administration cut off for expedited work permits for Venezuelans. She may still be able to apply for one, but the process is complicated and time-consuming. She says in the meantime, she's looking for any kind of work opportunity. Migrants like Estrada have to wait for months, sometimes even over a year, to get work authorization. She doesn't get any leads and leaves the job fair disappointed. So does Freddy Burbano. The 35-year-old was a pharmacy tech in Venezuela and arrived in the U.S. a couple of months ago. He's hoping to provide a better life for his two kids back home and is looking for any job he can find.
Sea cargando muebles, sea barriendo.
Urbano says he can move furniture, sweep, wash dishes at a restaurant. All he needs is to work. Without a job permit, he too leaves the fair empty-handed, but he says he trusts in God's timing.
El tiempo de Dios perfecto y eso llegará en algún momento para yo optar por los trabajos.
Meanwhile, employers at the job fair are also on the lookout. Like Gibson's, a steakhouse in downtown Chicago, the restaurant is desperate for workers.
I'm looking for 20 people, prep cooks, line cooks. That's the stations that we need to cover fast.
That's Noel Jaramillo, the executive chef at Gibson's. An hour into the fair, he says the number of people who came to his booth without work permits is overwhelming.
They have started the process or something like that, but at this time, unfortunately, there's nothing I can do about it.
So you give them a card and say, call me when you're ready?
Absolutely, yes, so they can reach out to me once if they get their permit or anything that allows them to get them through the system.
Lots of employers are in the same boat. For his part, Jaramillo says he hopes more migrants can get their job authorization so his industry and others can put them to work. In Chicago, I'm Esther Yunji Kang for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, today in which one cannot help but look at crypto and shake one's head again. Binance, the biggest cryptocurrency exchange in the world, and its CEO and founder, Changpeng Zhao, pleaded guilty today to charges of money laundering and sanctions violations, including letting Hamas and other terrorist groups use the platform. The company does get to keep operating. Zhao steps down as CEO. Penalties total in the billions of dollars. Again, would you take your paycheck in cryptocurrency? All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. A commodity futures contract we do not really cover all that much. Saw this on Bloomberg, that uranium prices have hit a 15-year high on growing demand for nuclear power. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital and on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.